Welcome to the Durant and Legacy Society's conference call with Christina Niobe Jones, Director, Wellesley College Botanic Gardens, and Adjunct Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dina Baranke-Rashes, class of 1996. Dina, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you everyone for joining us today. I'm delighted to welcome you to the Winter 2019 Durant and Legacy Society conference call. I am Dina Baranke-Rashes, class of 1996, chair of the Durant Society. I continue to be humbled by the role that the Durant and Legacy Societies play in the financial health of the college, and I'm so grateful to see the membership of both societies growing. Thank you for your generous support, your investment in Wellesley, and championing women who will make a difference in the world. The Durant Society continues to trend ahead of last year with 875 members contributing well over $21 million this fiscal year. The Wellesley Legacy Society honors those who've made life income gifts for the college and or remembered Wellesley in their estate plans. To date, the college has raised nearly $3.6 million in planned gifts and over $2.9 million in documented bequest intentions. Now I am pleased to introduce Christina Niobe Jones. Professor Jones is an ecologist wearing multiple hats at Wellesley. She is the director of the Botanic Gardens, adjunct assistant professor of biological sciences, and advisory faculty in the environmental studies program. Christina holds a PhD from the University of California, Davis, and has worked at Wellesley College since 1994. Her academic interests are at the intersection of gardening and science with the goal of improving stewardship of landscapes that are home to many species, including people. Each spring, she teaches an introductory course at Wellesley in environmental horticulture, and this fall will teach a seminar on biodiversity in the built environment. For these classes and a thriving work-study program, she uses the college's greenhouses and outdoor gardens as living laboratories. Thank you, Professor Jones, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dina, for that introduction and definitely for your leadership of the Durant Society. And many thanks to all of you for helping us to make this really such an exciting place to be. As Dina said, I've been at Wellesley since 1994, and there's no other place I'd rather be. The students get more amazing every year. I don't know how it happens. And the support for new initiatives is just wonderful and forward-thinking. It's really the incredible support from all of you and the Wellesley Effect that makes this place great. So I want to tell you the story of Global Flora, the project, and I'm going to do it in broad outlines because I can talk forever about details within that. So I'll fill in those details according to your questions in the end. So I'll try to stay on track and keep it relatively brief, although there's so much to say. So I took on the role of director of the Botanic Gardens in 2005 after a search, and with the understanding that the greenhouses needed to be replaced. Right? So we had these wonderful old greenhouses, the Margaret Ferguson greenhouses, which were built in the 1920s and were directly connected to the Science Center and which made it possible to work with living organisms all year round, which in New England, if you're here today, you know that that's not so easy to do. It's just not the growing season most of the time, and especially for spring semester. So we had these wonderful greenhouses that were also an important public face of the college, and they were in really, really tough shape. So, starting in 2005, we really started dreaming and planning, you know, what was possible. But the reality was we needed to get in line, right? There was a lot that needed to happen on this campus with the aging buildings everywhere. My office is in Sage. I understood very well that there were multiple needs. And finally, after, you know, making, I don't know how many different ways I can make the argument that this was crucial, right, to the science program at Wellesley, and in fact beyond that, because the art students were using it as well, it's just a real focal point for the college. I will never forget the meeting with the dean at the time, Dick French, when he said, we've got the budget. We're going to replace those greenhouses in kind, right? And I thought, that's amazing. But I'd been dreaming otherwise. I'd been dreaming that we could actually replace them with something that was better. I mean, they were really well designed for the 1920s, but we had other ideas for what they could be in this century. And he kind of looked at me sideways and said, well, this is the budget. but the plan was to build a superstructure over the existing greenhouse, take it down gradually from the inside. It was not trivial. And so it was a reasonably healthy budget. And I thought, you know what? I said, may I take this as a challenge for that budget to come up with something new, right, and that will meet our needs even better. And so after a bunch of planning, some work with some architects, we came up with some really exciting ideas. And these just got a huge push forward in 2013 when Mary White stepped in. She just asked for a tour of the greenhouses casually. I didn't know who she was. I was happy to give her a tour. And next thing you know, she's saying, you know what, I'm going to help you replace them. And in fact, this should go first. It's a nice sort of discrete project that is part of the science project. There's a huge need in the overall science center, and the greenhouses are something that if we can do them first in a really innovative way, it'll sort of show what we can do, staying within budget and just rethinking how is science happening now. And so that was a challenge and a really exciting opportunity. And so Mary was thinking, you know, just exactly the same ways that I was and the rest of us in the Botanic Gardens, we really wanted a more sustainable building, right? We were heating the great outdoors with the previous greenhouse. It was the typical single-paned glass, beautiful structure, but just, you know, the heating costs alone, I don't even want to know what they were. So we were looking for something that was both sustainable but also would continue Margaret Ferguson's vision for being a place that was attractive and engaging for everyone at Wellesley, not just the science students, and certainly not just the botanists. So we were going from a museum of plants, right? It was a wonderful space, especially students from warm places would just come to take refuge in the winter. There would be people painting in there. But it was a collection of really cool plants in pots, mostly, and some larger plants in the ground. It was also not really set up for groups to go through together. It was really designed, as most of the greenhouses were last century, for an individual journey. Walk through by yourself and check things out, and tour groups had to be very small. And there really wasn't any place where a whole lab group, for example, could gather. So those were the kinds of things that we wanted to build into this new structure without increasing the footprint, right, and without exceeding our budget. And I kept defending all the spaces for plants as well. So there was a lot of competing demand. And then we got to do an architect selection. And I will never forget the July day when it was about 95 degrees and there were a lot of architects that were interested in this project and they were all wearing black. And they gathered in the courtyard next to the greenhouse while I told them what we were trying to accomplish. And then we got to go into the old greenhouse, which was even hotter. And everybody was sweating, and I was explaining it, and finally this one voice perks up and says, sounds like you're talking about a playground for science. And that was Sheila Kennedy from Kennedyville Architecture, and they really got it in their bones what we were trying to do. And they've been amazing to work with. Sheila is a professor of architecture at MIT and she's just a rising star in the architecture world. She's also got an incredible eye for geometry. So if you look at that first picture, I think it's page number one, you can see the shape, a little bit of the shape. You can't fully appreciate it from above, but it was the best example I could give of the way the curve of the structure sits on that hill. It also follows the track of the sun from the east on the right around to the west. So what you're seeing there is a late afternoon shot, last bit of sun coming through the west end of the greenhouse. So it's just incredibly, it's a beautiful and highly functional shape and structure, and the geometry from all different angles is really stunning. So we got a great design team. Another thing that was really new and innovative, besides, you know, nobody's ever made a greenhouse in quite this shape before, is the material that it's made with. So you can see in the second page the architect's rendering of the interior view, those wide open spaces. So, you know, the structure, the steel structure, is much less, right? With this material, it's not glass on top. It's these ETFE, ethyl tetrafluoroethylene. They're pillows of air, basically, with this film around them. And you have to hold them down rather than hold them up, so you can have a much more lightweight structure and these huge expanses of open between the steel beams. It really feels like a bubble that's landed on the landscape, which is exactly what we were going for. Another really cool thing about ETFE is the quality of light that it lets through. Unlike glass, which deflects, well, depending on the kind of glass, various wavelengths, the ETFE lets everything through, including UV, so you have to wear sunscreen in there, and the plants will be reacting as if they were outside, right, except that the temperature is controlled, which they're going to like because they're going to be subtropical plants. So it's a really neat material that enabled that curved shape. It's also incredibly sustainable because we're using so much less steel, and it's a very good insulator because it's a pillow. So a little bit about this whole idea of the indoor landscape. So we wanted to get the plants out of their pots and into the ground. The theme of the Global Flora Collection, as we're calling it, at the Margaret Ferguson Greenhouses, is diversity of plant form, right? So the form of a plant, I can talk much more about this, but I'll just say briefly, it's a sort of a manifestation of the history of that plant, both its evolutionary history, how did it evolve to become that shape, but also its individual history, right? If a tree got hit by lightning, you will see that event in its shape forever. It's just that's how trees respond, how wood works. So the form of a plant, you can learn a ton from that. There's a lot of interesting geometry. There's mathematical, you know, constraints in the form, and, of course, there's a lot of beauty there. So by getting the plants out of their pots and into the ground and on top of each other, we let them really do their thing, right? They get to express their full form more than they could if they were constrained in pots. We'll still have to hold some of them back. Otherwise, they'll take over. But it really will be more like gardening indoors. All right, so anyway, there can be a lot said about that, but I will wait for questions there. So the third image shows you a little bit about the approach to this structure. So this is now, if you're looking at the first one, you're standing near the Science Center and looking towards it. So the building to the left is the Greenhouse Visitor Center, the Botanic Gardens Visitor Center. That's always been there since the 1990s. And then what's new is that wide open door to what we're calling the link that's going to connect that visitor center directly into the greenhouses. And we're taking advantage of that link space, which continues the curve of the greenhouse, to bring in artistic representations of the diversity of plants, sort of priming people for the experience once they walk into the greenhouse. And it's an opportunity for art students and our campus muralist, David Tang Olson, to sort of warm people up for the idea of plants are not all the same. They're not just this background greenery. There's a lot to see if you stop and look. So we're really excited about that collaboration with the artists. And there will be sort of rotating displays in there. And, again, I'm happy to talk more about that. So finally, and not at all, well, another piece of the architecture, you might see that little spaceship-looking thing in the courtyard. That is housing the Durant Camellia, as it's labeled on the first page. So that is the only tree that was in the ground. It was planted in the 1920s in the old greenhouses that we were afraid to move, right? It was just too risky. There is not another one like it in the world. And it had been in the ground for 90 years. So it is now a witness tree. It has seen the world come down around it and be built back up. And it for a number of reasons. It's not within the Global Flora Greenhouse proper. It has its own pavilion. It has different needs, and it'll be a very calm sort of zen space. It is a Japanese tree. There'll be a beautiful bench in there. It'll be just a quiet place to be. And it'll have the conditions that it needs to thrive. So we're really excited about that. So there's the Camellia Pavilion, the Link, as well as the greenhouse itself. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about how this connects to the rest of the Science Center, since really this was the vision, both for Mary, for Kathy Suma, the director of the Science Center, and for myself, that, you know, rethinking the greenhouses would help propel rethinking the sciences. And there's just a lot in common. So the greenhouses are a site, and have been for many years, they've been a site of really active hands-on learning, right? So Durant's themselves, you know, they had their own personal greenhouses on campus, and they, a big part of their legacy in the sciences is just, you know, providing every student with their own microscope. This was not something that you got anywhere. This really set Wellesley apart right from the beginning, that students had the opportunity to work hands-on, not just to hear people talk about things, but to find out for themselves how things work. So that hands-on learning opportunity that the greenhouses afforded, we're now really trying to imbue throughout the Science Center. And many of us, I'm part of a sort of a science pedagogy group. There's a whole lot of faculty that are very excited about, you know, just updated methods for engaging students in the sciences. One example is rather than having a separate lecture and lab section of a course, to combine those, we're calling it studio style. So, for example, the environmental horticulture class that I teach is 2 3-hour meetings a week. So there's not a separate lab section. We just kind of mix lab activities as appropriate, and I don't stand and lecture at them for more than about 5 minutes at a time, right, sort of just-in-time snippets as they're exploring materials on their own. So that kind of studio-style teaching is going to be enabled by the new spaces in the Science Center in a way that we really weren't able to do before. The classrooms were either too small in many cases to have this, you know, we're really up and around like in a lab, but at the same time you needed the sight lines that you have for a lecture, right, or for everyone to focus on a screen in front. That combination we just did not have, especially in SAGE, which is constrained by its architecture. We really couldn't reconfigure those classrooms. So this kind of active learning, you know, students just actually doing research starting from the introductory level in the sciences, it, you know, that's how you get students hooked. That's what got me hooked. I, you know, as an undergrad, I thought I wanted to be an engineer. And then I got to follow bumblebees and call it work. And, you know, it was amazing. There's nothing like actually doing the science. But, oh, you know, that's what it's about. It's not just about memorizing things, which was my high school science experience and which turned me off. So we are going to do our best to not turn off anybody and, in fact, to attract them with this spectacular new greenhouse and then, you know, welcome them into the reconfiguration of the Science Hill, which is going to be much more welcoming, much less of a fortress on the hill, and, you know, just the whole integration of some of the outdoor landscapes that are going to become more part of the feel of the Science Center, as well as these new classrooms and lab spaces. There's going to be a lab focused on food, I mean, where you can actually eat your experiments. That's incredible. That is such an exciting opportunity, and we'll definitely be using that in my classes. I think that's a lot of what I had to say. Again, I can expand on any of those things, but I think I'm now ready to take questions.
Thank you very much. At this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you will be placed in the queue in the order received. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your phone now. We are now ready to begin. Our first question will come from Barbara Mosler from class of 1965.
Yes, hello. I'm looking at slide number 4 and slide number 1, and I'm wondering if the building of SAGE is still going to be present in all its ancientness, or if it will be demolished and removed. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Yes, good question. So most of SAGE will be demolished and removed. This is part of what held up the actual building of the greenhouses, is to wait for the planning for the Science Center to move forward so that we understood what we were connecting to. So the wall of SAGE that used to be on the exterior and then was included in the interior when the rest of the Science Center was built in the 1970s, that wall is being preserved right now. In fact, there's huge structural steel going up to support it so that the rest of it can come down behind it. If you're looking at slide 4, you can see what looks like kind of a rectangular box almost in the middle, and then behind it, there's just a little bit of a raised area. That's one wing of SAGE back there, so it's a little bit hard for me to do this without a pointer, but behind that is where the focus area is, as we're calling it, that big open atrium. So that, it's just such a wonderful, it's an amazing story, actually. You know, Wellesley was one of the first, if not the first, to really do a big atrium inside a science center. And that wall that used to be exterior became interior. There's still a street light there that used to be on that exterior that's part of the interior decor. That is all staying. And the L wing, as we call it, the lab wing, and then the E wing, the newest part of the science center, those are also staying. But SAGE itself, except for that that wall all along the focus area on the inside, is coming down.
Thank you very much. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now. Our next question will come from Catherine Young, class of 1958.
My question is, again, about the cover. Could you explain again exactly that material that you said has air in the middle and it has to be held down? Exactly what is that, and is that in a rectangular form, or what is it?
Okay, the material is called ETFE, ethyl tetrafluoroethylene, and it's related to Teflon, believe it or not. So it's a film. It's not really, it's not a plastic. It's a polymer, right? It's a film. It's sort of like saran wrap on steroids. And it comes in these huge sheets that then, you know, we got it as a double sheet so that it could be inflated between those two sheets. It can also come as a triple pillow if you're really in, you know, Buffalo, New York or something. You know, there is actually another greenhouse in Buffalo that is made of this material. And so because it's a film, you have the opportunity to cut it in various shapes. And, in fact, no two of those panels that you can see is exactly the same size and shape. But that was not a problem, right? If that would just not be possible in glass. So it's bendable. It's inflatable. It's very, very light. And there's where I got excited about this is in England, there's an amazing pair of, well, I guess the set of greenhouses called the Eden Project, E-D-E-N, Eden, out in Cornwall on the west. And they're like bubbles. They call it the largest rainforest in captivity. It's under ETFE. And then there's a Mediterranean biome right there, you know, in Cornwall, England. And that's where I first experienced this material in a greenhouse application. I'm happy to answer more questions about it, but maybe that's enough.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Margaret Snowden, class of 1967.
I'm wondering if you're going to be able to have more than one ecosystem in the greenhouse, or if it's all the same ecosystem.
Great question. So there will be a divider About a third of the way from the right to the left, there will be a single, I don't know if pane is the right word, a single layer of ETFE dividing to the right will be the dry biome, and to the left will be the wet biome. They'll have more official names than that. And within the wet biome, there will be, we have some mangroves that will have their own tank, a very large tank for the mangroves, and some saltwater and some seagrasses and things like that. So that's its own little mini ecosystem. And there will be other mini ecosystems like that within each of these biomes. So, for example, in the dry biome, there will be deserts, and then there will also be more Mediterranean areas. It's not a huge expanse to work with. It's more like this garden bed it's not representing a particular place, but it is plants that are adapted to desert habitats or plants that are adapted to Mediterranean habitats will be co-located in those areas. Also, the north wall of the greenhouse will be a living wall. Right? We're working on these giant felt panels. So there's just going to be a variety of different places to plant things. But the landscapes themselves, the main divider will be just in the humidity between the two zones and the presence of a couple of different water bodies in the wet biome.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Karen Wilcox, class of 1964.
Oh, yes. This is very exciting, and I'm really delighted to see it. I have a lot of questions, but on slide four, it looks like there are also some traditional greenhouses coming out from the new science building. Is that true? And I'd also like to know whether you can still use the Honeywell Arboretum on the other side. Do you still teach from that? I don't know.
Great. So, yes, those are much more traditional greenhouses. They will be part of the new building that's going up to replace Sage. So they are replacing, if you remember the old greenhouse structure, it was kind of like a big M. There was a long swath of sort of the different habitat zones, the tropical house, the desert house, et cetera, and that's where the camellia was and a bunch of others. And then there were these three, we call them fingers, coming down from that main swath, and they connected to Sage. So we've really replaced that main axis with the global flora greenhouse, and then we've replaced the fingers, where we will be replacing the fingers, with these sort of off-the-shelf, we're calling them the teaching and research greenhouses now, for lack of a better name. Not like we're not teaching and researching in the global flora, but this is where we'll be growing plants in pots for classes, for research projects. There will be three different small modules within that for research purposes, where we can much more tightly control the temperature and other conditions. And one of them will be a big teaching greenhouse where you can have a whole lab section in there doing an experiment at the same time. So, yes, those are more traditional greenhouses, and they will be, as Margaret Ferguson always envisioned, directly connected to the new science center and to laboratory spaces. Oh, and the Arboretum, right. So the Arboretum, I think if you're thinking about the Honeywell Arboretum that's part of the Botanic Gardens on campus, absolutely. Those 22 acres are very much in use. They've been crucial while the greenhouses have been under construction for all the plant-loving students who have come and been disappointed by the lack of access to the greenhouses for the last 2 years. So, for example, the Edible Ecosystem Teaching Garden has been developed within the Honeywell Arboretum. We still have the amazing old oaks sort of anchoring that space and a great diversity of trees and shrubs and, neat landscapes to explore and get lost in out there. So that's been a really important part of teaching, and especially in the fall semester when it tends to be better weather to get out there. And then in the spring also we do a lot of looking for bud bursts, right? And anyway, there's a lot we do out there. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. Once again, to ask a question, star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question will come from Kathy Costin, class of 1967.
Hi, Christina. Thanks for the great presentation and special thanks for the slides. Very helpful. I have a simple question. What's the timeline for the opening of Global Flora and also for the opening of the Science Center?
So Global Flora will have its ribbon cutting at Reunion this year, and we are on track. I am so excited. It's been a very useful deadline. It happens to be Mary's 40th. I don't think it's a happens to be, but it's been a very useful sort of focal point that we've been working backwards from, and it's going to happen. You know, it may not be, it will be planted. It may not be fully planted. It, like any garden, it will keep getting better over time. But we won't be able to open to the public for another couple of years until the whole new science project is finished, just because we can't be attracting kids, for example, to a construction zone. So we'll be open to the college community. You know, I'm going to be teaching in it in the fall semester. I can't wait. And we will be doing tours, but it will not be, as we've always been in the past, just kind of open to the public as a resource. We're looking forward to that happening probably 2021. I think that's the target for the new Science Center to be completed, probably fall of 2021.
Thanks. Hard to wait.
Yeah.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Gretchen Besser, class of 1949.
Well, this has been a most exciting and wonderful presentation. I thank you immensely, Christina. You answered just now what I was going to ask, how much will we see at Reunion this June? I'm having my 70th. I doubt that I'll be here to see the full expansion, but it's really marvelous. I wanted to ask you two questions, one relatively unimportant. How flammable is ETF? And the second one was, what is the overall cost of this project, and are the funds in place?
Okay, so I forgot to say about the ETFE, if it catches on fire, it evaporates. So that's, it wasn't enough to convince the powers that be that we didn't need a sprinkler system in there, unfortunately, but it is very, very low on the flammability rating. So it's really a marvelous material for this application. And it's getting used more and more now for football stadium covers and, you know, just in large public venues. So it's really catching on. And then the overall cost. Yeah, right. So the initial budget for this in 2013 was $8 million. That was the budget I was given to replace the greenhouses. And then the project was paused, and so there was some escalation just, you know, accounting for the time lost. So the budget now is $11 million. And the funding, thank you to Mary White and to Nan Scow, the funding is in place.
Thank you very much. Our next question will come from Susan Schneider, class of 1986.
Yeah, hi there. I just had a quick question about that material again. How it, you know, seems kind of ideal in many ways, but at the same time, having, you know, wondering whether, how resistant it is to things like branches blowing through it in a storm and things like that, and what it would take to replace it, you know, various panels, you know, financially and time wise if need be, in response to something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, great question. These are all serious considerations. It took a lot of convincing of the college facilities folks that this was not going to be a maintenance nightmare. It is very, very resilient to anything except a very, very sharp poke, right? So actually on the, you can't see it in any of these images, I don't think, but on the ground level below that roof area is glass. Because you could take a knife to it and slash it open. Branches are supposed to bounce off it, and that was the experience that, you know, everyone that I talked to, and I talked to everyone, I think, that has a greenhouse made of this stuff now, that has been their experience. At the Eden Project, someone swung around with a ladder and swiped a hole in it, and you can just kind of tape it with the same material. So it's very, very easy to repair that kind of a slash. The facilities guy at the Eden Project is over the moon about this compared to glass. The one issue they've had is an insistent seagull trying to get in. And they solved that problem with a hawk. So, and the, another really amazing thing that's very different from, you know, a lot of agricultural greenhouses will have a polyethylene or polycarbonate coverings over them that yellow over a few years. They have to be replaced regularly. ETFE is incredibly stable. And, you know, the, it's supposed to last indefinitely. You know, I don't know what that means. The Eden Project was built in 2000, and it's still going strong with no deterioration detected. There are other greenhouses in Germany that are 40 years old that are also not deteriorated at all. So that's really exciting. Nothing sticks to it, being Teflon-related, and that's often the case of what starts deterioration. There's something that sticks to it, and then you know, you get a buildup around that, and next thing you know, you've got an issue. Everything slides off. In fact, it's amazing to be there when it's raining because the rain just races down it. It's quite something. It's also, it transmits the sound of the rain a lot, almost like being in a tin roof.
Cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to ask a question, that is star one on your telephone keypad now. Speakers, at this time, we have no further questions in the queue.
Well, thank you again, Professor Jones, for sharing about the Global Flora Project and its relationship to the overall vision for Science Hill. To everyone joining us on the call, thank you again for listening in, and I hope to see you at the Durant and Legacy Society events in Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York City this spring. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you. If participants have any further questions, you may contact the Development Office at 1-800-358-3543. Thank you for joining us. This conference has now concluded. You may disconnect your phone lines.